When you speak of your great friend, you describe the union and kinship as being de uña y mugre. Our friendship is like the fingernail and the dirt under it. Our image of who God is and what's on God's mind is more tiny than it is troubled. It trips more on our puny sense of God than over conflicting creedal statements or theological considerations. The desire of God's heart is immeasurably larger than our imaginations can conjure. This longing of God's to give us peace and assurance and a sense of well-being only awaits our willingness to cooperate with God's limitless magnanimity. Behold the one beholding you and smiling. It is precisely because we have such an overactive disapproval gland ourselves that we tend to create God in our own image. It is truly hard for us to see the truth that disapproval does not seem to be part of God's DNA. God is just too busy loving us to have any time left for disappointment. One day I receive a phone call in my office around 3 p.m. It's from a 25-year-old homie named Caesar. I've known him for most of his life. I can remember first meeting him when he was a little kid in Pico Gardens during the earthquake of 1987, when the projects had become a tent city. People lived outside in carpas well past the time of any danger. Caesar was one of the many kids seeking reassurance from me. Are we going to be okay? Is this the end of the world? I spent every evening of those 2 weeks walking the tents, and I always associate Caesar with that period. He's calling me today because he has just finished a 4-year stint in prison. Turned out earthquakes were the least of Caesar's troubles. He had joined the local gang since there wasn't anyone around to chase his ass and rein him in. At this point in his life, Caesar had been locked up more often than not. Caesar and I chit-chat on the phone, dispatching the niceties in short order. It's good to be out. I'd love to see you. Then Caesar says, let me just cut to the cheese. This was not a spin I had heard on this expression before. You know, I just got out of the Pinta and don't really have a place to stay. Right now I'm staying with a friend in his apartment here in El Monte, away from the projects and the hood and the homies. Y sabes que? I don't got no clothes. My lady, she left me, and she burned all my clothes, you know, in some anger toward me, I guess. I'm waiting for him to cut to the cheese. So I don't got no clothes, he says. Can you help me? Sure, son, I say. Look, it's 3 now. I'll pick you up after work at 6 o'clock. I drive to the apartment at the appointed hour, and I'm surprised to see Caesar standing on the sidewalk waiting for me. I'm used to searching for homies when asked to retrieve them. I guess you might say that Caesar is a scary-looking guy. It's not just the fact that he's large and especially fresh out of prison, newly swole from lifting weights. He exudes menace. So there he is standing and waiting for me. When he sees it's me, this huge ex-con does this bouncing up and down, yippee-skippy, happy-to-see-ya hand-clapping, gleeful jig. He flies into my car and throws his arms around me. When I saw you right now, gee, I got all happy. There was some essence to him that hadn't changed from that child wanting to know that the world was safe from earthquakes. We go to JCPenney, and I tell him he can buy $200 worth of clothes. In no time, his arms are filled with the essentials, and we both are standing in a considerable line to pay for it all. All the other customers are staring at Caesar. Not only is he menacing, but he seems to have lost his volume knob. People can't help but turn and look, though they all take great pains to pretend they're not listening. Hey, he says in what you might call a loud-ass voice. See that couple over there? I'm not the only one turning and looking. The entire checkout line shifts. Caesar points to a young couple with a tiny son. Well, I walk up to that guy, and I look at him, and I say, hey,
Don't I know you? And as Ruka grabs a mojito and holds him and shakes her head and says, no, we don't know you. Oh, paniquiada, sí. Then the vato looks at me like he's going to have a damn paro cardiaco. And he shakes his head. No, I don't know you. Then I look at him more closer and I say, oh, my bad. I thought you were somebody else. And they get all relaxed when I say that. He takes a breath. I mean, damn, G. Do I look that scary?
I shake my head no and say, yeah, pretty much, dog. The customers can't help themselves and we all laugh. I drop Caesar off at his friend's apartment. He becomes quiet and vulnerable, as frightened as a child displaced by shifting ground. I just don't want to go back. La neta, I'm scared. Look, son, I say to him. Who's got a better heart than you? And God is at the center of that great big old heart. Hang on to that, dog, because you have what the world wants. So what can go wrong? We say our goodbyes, and as I watch him walk away alone, I find his gentleness and disarming sweet soul a kind of elixir, soothing my own doubts and calling me to fearlessness. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. It's Caesar. He says what every homie says when they call in the middle of the night. Did I wake you? I always think, why no, I was just waiting and hoping that you'd call. Caesar is sober, and it's urgent that he talk to me.
I gotta ask you a question. You know how I've always seen you as my father, ever since I was a little kid? Well, I have to ask you a question.
Now Caesar pauses, and the gravity of it all makes his voice waver and crumple.
Have I been your son?
Oh, hell yeah, I say. Whew, Caesar exhales.
I thought so.
Now his voice becomes enmeshed in the cadence of gentle sobbing.
Then I will be your son. And you will be my father. And nothing will separate us, right?
That's right. In this early morning call, Caesar did not discover that he has a father. He discovered that he is a son worth having. The voice broke through the clouds of his terror and the crippling mess of his own history, and he felt himself beloved. God, wonderfully pleased in him, is where God wanted Caesar to reside. Jesus in Matthew's gospel says, how narrow is the gate that leads to life. Mistakenly, I think, we've come to believe that this is about restriction. The way is narrow. But it really wants us to see that narrowness is the way. St. Hedwig writes, all is narrow for me. I feel so vast. It's about funneling ourselves into a central place. Our choice is not to focus on the narrow, but to narrow our focus. The gate that leads to life is not about restriction at all. It is about an entry into the expansive. There is a vastness in knowing you're a son or daughter worth having. We see our plentitude in God's own expansive view of us, and we marinate in this. In March of 2004, Scrappy walks into our office, and I'm not proud to admit it. My heart sinks. From the perch of my own glass-enclosed office, I can see Scrappy talking to Marcos, the receptionist, who is also from Scrappy's gang. He is apparently signing up to see me. I haven't seen Scrappy in 10 years, since he's been incarcerated all that time. But even before that, I'm not sure if he's ever set foot in my office. My heart is in some lower register. Let's just say Scrappy and I have never been on good terms. I first met him in the summer of 1984. I was newly ordained at Dolores Mission. He was 15 years old. and his probation officer assigned him to the church to complete his hours of community service. The chip located on his shoulder was the size of a Pontiac.
I don't have to listen to you. I don't have to do what you say.
Some 5 years later, I'm standing in front of a packed church preaching at the funeral of one of Scrappy's homeboys.
If you love Kukul and you want to honor his memory, I say to the congregation, then you will work for peace and love your enemies.
Immediately, Scrappy stands up, moves out of his pew and into the center aisle. All eyes are on him. I stop speaking. The eternal scowl I had come to know in that summer of 1984 is fixed on me as he walks straight ahead. We stand face to face. He mad-dogs me with some intensity, then turns and exits the church by the side door. 3 years later, I'm riding my bike, as I would in those days, patrolling the projects at night. I enter Scrappy's barrio, and there is a commotion. The homies have formed a circle, and clearly two of their rank are going head up. I break through the mob and, indeed, find Scrappy throwing down with one of his own homies. I discover later that the beef was over some hyena, a girl. I stop the fight, and Scrappy reaches into the front waist of his pants and pulls out a gun that he waves around wildly. The crowd seems to be more horrified than I am. There are great gasps and pleas.
Hey, dog, damn, put the gun away. Don't disrespect G.
Scrappy steadies the gun right at me and grunts a half laugh.
Shit, I'll shoot his ass too.
Are you getting a sense of what our relationship was like? So years later, when I see him enter my office, it takes me a moment, but I locate my heart hiding in Filene's basement, and Marcos intercoms me. Scrappy's here. Then his voice gets squeaky and tentative. You want to see him? Marcos knew enough that this would be in some doubt.
Course. Send him in.
Scrappy is not a large fellow, but there is no fat in his mid-sized build. His hair is slicked back and his mustache is understated. He hugs me only because not to would be too awkward. We have, after all, known each other for 20 years. He sits and wastes no time.
Look, let's just be honest with each other and talk man to man. You know that I've never disrespected you.
I figure, why not? I'm gonna go for it.
Well, how about the time you walked out on my homily at Kukul's funeral? Or the time you pulled a cuete out on me?
Scrappy looks genuinely perplexed by what I've just said, and cocks and scrunches his face like a confused beagle.
Yeah, well, besides that, he says.
And then we do something we never have in our 2 decades of knowing each other. We laugh. But really, truly laugh, head resting on my desk laughter. We carry on until this runs its course, and then Scrappy settles into the core of his being, beyond the bravado of his chingon status in his gang. I have spent the last 20 years building a reputation for myself, and now I regret that I even have one. And then in another moment he cries, but really truly cries. He's doubled over, and the rocking seems to soothe the release of this great ache. When the wailing stops and he comes up for air, he daubs his eyes and runs his sleeve across his nose. He finally makes eye contact.
Now what do? I know how to sell drugs. I know how to gangbang. I know how to shank fools in prison. I don't know how to change the oil in my car. I know how to drive, but I don't know how to park. And I don't know how to wash my clothes, except in the sink of a cell. I hire him that day, and he begins work the next morning on our graffiti crew. Scrappy discovered, as scripture has it, that where he is standing is holy ground. He found the narrow gate that leads to life. God's voice was not of restriction,
to shape up or ship out. Scrappy found himself in the center of vastness and right in the expansive heart of God. The sacred place toward which God had nudged Scrappy all his life is not to be arrived at, but discovered. Scrappy did not knock on the door so God would notice him. No need for doors at all. Scrappy was already inside. God seems to be an unwilling participant in our efforts to pigeonhole him. The minute we think we've arrived at the most expansive sense of who God is, this great wild God, as the poet Hafez writes, breaks through the claustrophobia of our own articulation, and things get large again. Richard Rohr writes in Everything Belongs that nothing of our humanity is to be discarded. God's unwieldy love, which cannot be contained by our words, wants to accept all that we are and sees our humanity as the privileged place to encounter this magnanimous love. No part of our hardwiring or our messy selves is to be disparaged. Where we stand in all our mistakes and imperfection is holy ground. It is where God has chosen to be intimate with us, and not in any way but this. Scrappy's moment of truth was not in recognizing what a disappointment he's been all these years. It came in realizing that God had been beholding him and smiling for all this time, unable to look anywhere else. It is certainly true that you can't judge a book by its cover, nor can you judge a book by its first chapter, even if that chapter is 20 years long. When the vastness of God meets the restriction of our own humanity, words can't hold it. The best we can do is find the moments that rhyme with this expansive heart of God. Shortly after I was ordained, I spent a year in Cochabamba, Bolivia. It was a gracious time that changed me forever. My Spanish was quite poor, and the year was to be filled with language study and ministry. I could celebrate the Eucharist in Spanish after a summer at Dolores Mission, but I was a slave to the Missal for some time to come. Early on, I began to minister to a community named Temporal, which had been without a priest for a long time. A few weeks into my time there, I was approached by a group of health workers who asked me to celebrate Mass in Terani. This was a Quechua community located high above Cochabamba, whose indigenous folks harvested flowers for market. It was common to see campesinos making the long trek from Terani with a huge weight of flowers tied to their backs. Like beasts of burden, they were doubled over all the way to town. The health workers explained that the Quechua Indians in Terani have not seen a priest in a decade, so they asked me to celebrate the Mass in Spanish, and one of the workers would preach in Quechua. Everyone there speaks Quechua, with only the men able to defend themselves in Spanish. The workers picked me up at the bottom of the hill at 1 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. I hop into the back of the open-air truck with the others, and we climb to the top of the mountain. Mid-trek, I decide to do an inventory of the contents of my backpack. I have brought everything I need, but a missalette. I have not the words. At this point in my early priesthood, I couldn't wing Mass in English. The thought of doing so in Spanish was preposterous. I do have a Spanish Bible, so I frantically flip through the pages, trying to find any passages that sound like the words of consecration. Take this and eat. I locate any part of the New Testament that has Jesus kicking it at a table and eating. Soon, my body is introducing me to the marvels of flop sweat. And I haven't even arrived at Tirana yet. I am red in the face and stingy hot. We pull into a huge open-air landing, a field cleared of all crops, and many hundreds of Quechua Indians have gathered and set themselves down around this table, our altar. I hobble and fake my way through the liturgy of the word, aided by the health workers who read everything in Quechua. After the gentleman preaches, it's my turn to carry the ball. I'm like someone who's been in a major car accident. I can't remember a thing. I know only that I have a crib sheet with some notes I've made, with stolen scriptural quotations, all the while lifting the bread and wine whenever I run out of things to say. It would be hard to imagine this Mass going worse. When it is over, I'm left spent and humiliated. I'm wandering adrift, trying to gather my shattered self back together again, when a female health worker walks an ancient Quechua woman up to me. She hasn't gone to confession in 10 years. She leaves her with me, and the viejita unloads a decade's worth of sins in a sing-songy and rapid-fire Quechua. I just nod like a menso, waiting for a pause that might indicate she's finished. The woman's got some pulmones on her and doesn't seem to need to take a breath. She goes on for about a half hour. Finally, she does stop, and I manage to communicate some penance and give her my memorized absolution. She walks away, and I turn to discover that I have been abandoned. The field where we celebrated Mass has been vacated. Inexplicably, even the truck and the health workers are gone. I am alone at the top of this mountain, stuck, not only without a ride, but in stultifying humiliation. I am convinced that a worse priest has never visited this place or walked this earth. With my backpack snug on my shoulder and spirit deflated, I begin to make the long walk down the mountain back to town. But before I leave the makeshift soccer field that had been our cathedral, an old Quechua campesino, seemingly out of nowhere, makes his way to me. He appears ancient, but I suspect his body has been weathered by work and the burden of an Indian's life. As he nears me, I see he's wearing tethered wool pants with a white buttoned shirt, greatly frayed at the collar. He has a rope for a belt. His suit coat is coarse and worn. He has a fedora, toughened by the years. He's wearing huaraches, and his feet are caked with Bolivian mud. Any place that a human face can have wrinkles and creases, he has them. He is at least a foot shorter than I am, and he stands right in front of me and says, "Tatai." This is Quechua for Padrecito, a word packed with cariño, affection, and a charming intimacy. He looks up at me with penetrating, weary eyes and says, "Tatai, gracias por haber venido. Thanks for coming." I think of something to say, but nothing comes to me, which is just as well, because before I can speak, the old campesino reaches into the pockets of his suit coat and retrieves 2 fistfuls of multicolored rose petals. He's on the tips of his toes and gestures that I might assist with the inclination of my head. And so he drops the petals over my head, and I'm without words. He digs into his pockets again and manages 2 more fistfuls of petals. He does this again and again, and the store of red, pink, and yellow rose petals seems infinite. I just stand there and let him do this, staring at my own huaraches, now moistened with my tears, covered with rose petals. Finally, he takes his leave, and I'm left there alone, with only the bright aroma of roses. For all the many times I would return to Tirani and see the same villagers over and over, I never saw this old campesino again. God, I guess, is more expansive than every image we think rhymes with God. How much greater is the God we have than the one we think we have? More than anything else, the truth of God seems to be about a joy that is a foreigner to disappointment and disapproval. This joy just doesn't know what we're talking about when we focus on the restriction of not measuring up. This joy, God's joy, is like a bunch of women lined up in the parish hall on your birthday, wanting only to dance with you, cheek to cheek. First things, recognizably first, as Daniel Berrigan says. The God who is greater than God has only one thing on her mind, and that is to drop endlessly rose petals on our heads. Behold the one who can't take his eyes off of you. Marinate in the vastness of that. Chapter 2. Disgrace. Most of the masses I do in the probation camps take place on Saturday morning. Then I race home for an afternoon of baptisms, weddings, and quinceañeras at Dolores Mission. These usually start at 1 or 2 in the afternoon. I have a narrow window of half an hour one day between my morning masses in the camps and my 1 o'clock baptism, so I stop by the office and go through the day's mail. I'm not there 15 minutes when this woman in her 30s walks through the door. I immediately glance at the clock hanging on the wall. I check how much time I have left before the baptism, and am already lamenting that I most probably won't get to all the mail. I find out later that the woman's name is Carmen. She's a recognizable figure on First Street, and yet this is her first visit to Homeboy. Today is the moment she chooses. Carmen is a heroin addict, gang member, street person, occasional prostitute, and a champion peleonera. She's often defiantly storming down the street, usually shouting at someone. She's a real gritona, hollering at the men inside the mitla bar as she stumbles out to the sidewalk. I've heard her a number of times arguing loudly on the payphone with relatives or friends. Damn! Just let me stay tonight! Now I have 7 minutes until my baptism. Carmen is a dusty blonde, which couldn't be the color God originally gave her. She's attractive, but so worn by heroin and street life. She plops herself into one of the chairs in my office and cuts the fat out of her introductory remarks. I need help. She launches right in, brash and something of a no-shit sister. Oh, she says, I've been to like 50 rehabs. I'm known all over, nationwide. She smiles. Her eyes wander around my office and she studies all the photographs hanging there. She multitasks, and her inspection of the place doesn't derail her stream of consciousness rambling. The family will arrive for the baptism in 5 minutes. I went to Catholic school all my life. Fact, I graduated from high school even. Fact, right after graduation is when I started to use heroin. Carmen enters some kind of trance at this point, and her speech slows to deliberate and halting. And I have been trying to stop since the moment I began. Then I watch as Carmen tilts her head back until it meets the wall. She stares at the ceiling, and in an instant her eyes become these two ponds, water rising to meet their edges, swollen banks spilling over. Then, for the first time, really, she looks at me and straightens. I am a disgrace. Suddenly her shame meets mine, for when Carmen walked through that door, I had mistaken her for an interruption. Author John Bradshaw claims that shame is at the root of all addictions. This would certainly seem to be true with the gang addiction. In the face of all this, the call is to allow the painful shame of others, to have a purchase on our lives. Not to fix the pain, but to feel it. Belden Lane, the theologian, writes, "Divine love is incessantly restless until it turns all woundedness into health, all deformity into beauty, and all embarrassment into laughter." Yet there is a palpable sense of disgrace strapped like an oxygen tank onto the back of every homie I know. In a letter from prison, a gang member writes, "People see me like less." This is hard to get through and penetrate. "You're no good. You live in the projects. Your mom's a basehead. Your dad's a tecato. You're wearing the same clothes today that you wore yesterday." I had a little project kid in my office who someone told me had regularly been late for school and missing class, so I bring this to his attention. "I hear you've been late for school a lot." He cries immediately, "I don't got that much clothes." He had so internalized the fact that he didn't have clean clothes or enough of them that it infected his very sense of self. I knew an inmate, Lefty, at Folsom State Prison, whose father would, when Lefty was a child, get drunk and beat his mom. One Saturday night, Lefty's father beat his mother so badly that the next day she had to be led around by his sisters as if she were blind. Both of her eyes were swollen shut. On Sunday, Lefty's father and brothers are sitting on the couch watching a football game. Lefty calmly goes into his parents' bedroom, retrieves a gun from his father's bedstand, and walks out to the living room. Lefty places himself in front of the television. His father and brothers push themselves as far back into the couch as possible, horrified. Lefty points the gun at his father and says, "You are my father, and I love you. If you ever hit my mother again, I will kill you." Lefty was 9 years old. He didn't kill his father then or ever. And yet part of the spirit dies a little each time it's asked to carry more than its weight in terror, violence, and betrayal. By the tender mercy of God, Scripture has it, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet in the way of peace. How do those who sit in darkness find the light? The poet Shelley writes, "To love and bear, to hope till hope creates from its own wreck the thing it contemplates." How does one hang in there with folks, patiently taking from the wreck of a lifetime of internalized shame, a sense that God finds them, us, wholly acceptable? Part of the problem is that at its core we tend to think that shame and sin, if you will, happen to someone else. My shame can't meet Carmen's unless I dispel that notion. I remember a woman who came to Mass every day at Dolores Mission, and during the time of petitionary prayer, she always said the same thing. "Por los pecadores, para que ellos," for sinners, so that they. It was never sinners we. It seemed outside of who she was. Yet it's precisely within the contour of one's shame that one is summoned to wholeness. Even there, Psalm 39 tells us, even in the darkest place we are known, yes, even there. My own falsely self-assertive and harmful, unfree ego gets drawn into the expansive heart of God. It is precisely in the light of God's vastness and acceptance of me that I can accept the harm I do for what it is. There is a longing in us all to be God enthralled, so enthralled that to those hunkered down in their disgrace, in the shadow of death, we become transparent messengers of God's own tender mercy. We want to be seized by that same tenderness. We want to bear the largeness of God. I hate the 4th of July. In my barrio, it lasts 2 whole months, all of June and all of July. The place is Beirut for 60 days. Fireworks, firecrackers, sticks of dynamite, endless and annoying. On one Tuesday morning during this season, I'm in my office, and suddenly there is the rat-a-tat-tat of successive firecrackers, whose source seems to be the bathroom off the kitchen area. The din is astounding, and of course I'm madder in hell. By the time I get there, a homegirl, Candy, is a banshee, screaming in the mascara of the alleged culprit, Danny. How dare you disrespect G's office like that? Who are you to tell me something? He roars back. At 19 years old, he's a runt, half Candy's size, but he's certainly not going to let himself. I can smell the sulfur of the firecrackers wafting out of the bathroom as I peel these two apart and lead Danny out to the parking lot. Normally, I'd want to throttle this kid and give him, as they say, what for. I manage something I rarely can. I morph into Mother Teresa and Gandhi. How you doing? I gently speak to Danny on the hot asphalt of the parking lot. I didn't did it! Danny gives me both barrels in perfect homie grammar. I didn't did it! I know, I say in full Ajari Contra mode, going against every grain in my being. I know, I know. But I'm worried about you, I say as quiet as I can be. How you doing?
Okay.
Did you eat anything today?
No.
I give him $5. Why don't you go across the street to Jim's and get something to eat? Danny starts to walk away and mumbles loud enough to be heard.
Even though you don't believe me.
I call him back. Danny, if you tell me you didn't do it, mijo, then that's all I need. Danny stands in the hot July sun and begins to weep. Cornered by shame and disgrace, he acquiesces to a vastness not mine. Author and psychiatrist James Gilligan writes that the self cannot survive without love, and the self, starved of love, dies. The absence of self-love is shame, just as cold is the absence of warmth, disgrace obscuring the sun. Guilt, of course, is feeling bad about one's actions, but shame is feeling bad about oneself. Failure, embarrassment, weakness, overwhelming worthlessness, and feeling disgracefully less than, all permeating the marrow of the soul. Mother Teresa told a roomful of lepers once how loved by God they were and a gift to the rest of us. Interrupting her, an old leper raises his hand and she calls on him.
Could you repeat that again? It did me good. So would you mind just saying it again?
Franciscan Richard Rohr writes that the Lord comes to us disguised as ourselves. We come to believe that we grow into this. The only thing we know about Jesus growing up is that he grew in age, wisdom, and favor with God. But do we really grow in favor with God? Did Jesus become increasingly more favorable to God? Or did he just discover over time that he was wholly favorable? Lula grew up in our office. He's in his early 20s now and has a son. He was 10 when he first wandered in. I'd met him in Aliso Village at the annual Easter egg hunt. This was no White House lawn affair, just something thrown together very last minute by the ladies of the parish but the kids seemed to have a good time. Lula was a skinny kid who looked straight out of the third world, undernourished, filthy. He was standing by himself, and no one seemed to include him or pay him much attention, except when they'd steal his eggs.
"My name is Luis, but everybody calls me Lula," he said.
I remembered this a week later when I pull up to an intersection and see him entering the crosswalk alone, his walk clumsy and self-conscious. I roll down my window and catch his attention. "Hey, Lula!" You would have thought I had electrocuted him. His whole body spasms with delight to be known, to be called, to hear his name uttered out loud. For his entire trip through the crosswalk, Lula kept turning back and looking at me, smiling. Lula didn't do well in school. He was special ed throughout and famously a slowpoke. It was often the third bounce before he got what you were talking about. He didn't know how to tell time until Lupe Mosqueda, a member of our staff, taught him using a paper plate with movable hands. He was probably 15 when he learned the concept of time. All of us at Homeboy taught him to remember his birthday. Until he was 14, he had no clue. Once, he walked into the office wearing one of those red ribbons given at school to commemorate one thing or another. "Hey, Lula," I asked him, "what's the ribbon for?" He stares intently at it and thinks for a goodly amount of time. "For free drugs," he says. "Well, Lula," I help, "maybe it stands for drug-free week." "Yeah," he says, "that one." When he was 17, he was included in a youth group trip to Washington, D.C. Someone subsidized his trip. While there, he finds a payphone on the mall and calls the Homeboy toll-free number. "I'm calling from the memorial," he shouts. "Which memorial, Lula?" I shout back over the din of his background noise. Lula pauses a really long time because I suspect he doesn't actually know. "The penny guy," he shouts. "You mean the Lincoln Memorial," I say. "Yeah," he concedes, "that one." When Lula first started to come to the office shortly after I met him, he'd make a beeline to my office and just sit there. He was not much of a conversationalist. One day, when Lula passed by all the other desks and staff members to get to my office, several called him back. "Lula, you come back here. Hey, where do you think you're going?" They proceeded to explain to Lula the whole, what are we, chopped liver concept, that it was rude to walk past folks without greeting them. They suggested he try it again. Lula goes to the front door, exuberant at the mere idea that folks would actually want to be greeted by him. He walks in again, and in a sing-songy, lilting voice, nearly approximating Gregorian chant, says, "Hello, everybody!" He would enter our office for the next 5 years with this exact same greeting. Lula came from a huge family, and he was attention deficient, except in our office. Everyone lavished Lula with care he didn't get otherwise. 10-year-old Lula walks into my office one day and stands in the doorway. I suppose he's kept from fully entering by the fact that we are in the midst of a meeting with the job developers. He's positioned at the entrance and holds up a piece of paper, smiling broadly and doing a dance, not unlike one that indicates the need for a restroom. I can see from where I sit that it's a report card. That Lula, who does so poorly in school, would be ecstatic about his grades, is cause to halt the meeting. "You come on over here, Lula." I wave him in, and he navigates the adults who are sitting in his way. He hands me the report card and stands by my side, resting his elbow on my shoulder. His glee cannot be contained. I glance across the piece of paper in front of me and locate the subjects. FFF, FFF, all Fs, and nothing but damn Fs. I think, why is he so excited to show me this thing? I am frantically perusing every inch of this report card to find something, anything, for which to praise Lula. I find it. Absences. Zero. Lula, nice going, mijo. You didn't miss a day. I'm thinking a lot of good it did you. You didn't miss a day. I high-five him as he starts to leave the office. One of our job developers, John Tostado, stops Lula right there. Hey, Lula, how would you like to win $5? Lula indicates that he'd like this just fine. So here's the deal, John says, as he removes a crisp, new $5 bill from his wallet. If you can answer this question correctly, the $5 are yours. Lula starts to giggle, and you can practically see him readying for battle. He actually limbers up and shakes himself out. For Lula, this is the College Bowl. All right, Lula, here's the question. John begins, his voice the moral equivalent of a drum roll. How old was I when I was your age? Lula contorts his face and pounds his small fist against his forehead, herniating himself to come up with the right answer. All of us in the room hold our collective breath. A moment comes when you actually can see the light bulb above Lula's head ding on. 10 years old, Lula belts out. High fives abound, and Lula is handed his cash prize. He walks to the door and holds up the booty with his two hands. That was easy, he says. Simone Weil was right. Those who are unhappy have no need for anything in this world but people capable of giving them their attention. You could add to that the need to pull the favor right out of you so that you don't try to grow in favor but recognize that you have always been wholly favorable. Homies have been outside for so long they forget there is an inside. Their sense of isolation is suffocating, and they are quick to throw in the towel. One day, a very sad kid stumbles into my office and collapses into a chair. A homie with kids and other adult worries before he's able to handle them. He just gives up. That's it. I'm moving. Where are you moving to? Mars. Mars? Yeah. This planet is tired of my ass already. A homie trying to put words to this particular pain writes, my spirit is so sore. It hurts to be me. On occasion, I will do an intake on a homie who comes into our office looking for one of our services, tattoo removal, job placement, counseling, etc. If I had a dollar for every time the following happens, I could close down my development office. I have the intake form, and I'm interviewing the homie seated in front of me. How old are you? And the homie says, me? And I'm thinking, no, what's your dog's age? We are the only ones in the room. And he says, me? Well, yes, you. Oh, I'm 18. Do you have a driver's license? Me? Again, I think, no, I was wondering if your grandmother is still driving. Yes, you. No, I don't have a license. The toxicity gets so internalized that it obliterates the me. You couldn't possibly have interest in knowing things about me. Sure, you're not talking about somebody else who happens not to be in the room. All throughout Scripture and history, the principal suffering of the poor is not that they can't pay their rent on time or that they are $3 short of a package of Pampers. As Jesus scholar Marcus Borg points out, the principal suffering of the poor is shame and disgrace. It is a toxic shame, a global sense of failure of the whole self. This shame can seep so deep down. I asked a homie once after Mass at a probation camp if he had any brothers and sisters. Yeah, he says, I have one brother and one sister. And then he's quick to add, with emphasis, but they're good. Oh, I tell him, and that would make you here, he says, locked up. And that would make you, I try again, bad, he says. Homie seemed to live in the zip code of the eternally disappointing and need a change of address. To this end, one hopes, against all human inclination, to model not the one false move God, but the no matter whatness of God. You seek to imitate the kind of God you believe in, where disappointment is, well, Greek to him. You strive to live the black spiritual that says, God looks beyond our fault and sees our need. Before this can take hold in gang members, they strut around in protective shells of posturing, which stunts their real and complete selves. Often after Mass at the camps, kids will line up to talk one-on-one. The volunteers sometimes invite the minors to confession, but usually the kids just want to talk, be heard, get a blessing. At Camp Afflerbaugh, I'm seated on a bench outside in a baseball field, and one by one, the homies come over to talk briefly. This day, there's quite a lineup. The next kid approaching, I can tell, is all swagger and pose. His walk is chingon in its highest gear. His head bobs side to side to make sure all eyes are riveted. He sits down, we shake hands, but he seems unable to shake the scowl etched across his face. What's your name? I ask him. Sniper, he sneers. Okay, look, I'd been down this block before. I have a feeling you didn't pop out of your mom, and she took one look at your ass and said, Sniper. So come on, dog, what's your name? Gonzalez. He relents a little. Okay, now, son, I know the staff here will call you by your last name. I'm not down with that. Tell me, mijo, what's your mom call you? Cabrón. There is even the slightest flicker of innocence in his answer. Oye, no cabe duda, but son, I'm looking for birth certificate here. The kid softens. I can tell it's happening. But there is embarrassment and a newfound vulnerability. Napoleon, he manages to squeak out, pronouncing it in Spanish. Wow, I say, that's a fine, noble, historic name. But I'm almost positive that when your jefita calls you, she doesn't use the whole nine yardas. Come on, mijito, do you have an apodo? What's your mom call you? Then I watch him go to some far distant place, a location he has not visited in some time. His voice, body language, and whole being are taking on a new shape right before my eyes. Sometimes, his voice so quiet, I lean in. Sometimes, when my mom's not mad at me, she calls me Napito. I watch this kid move, transformed from sniper to Gonzalez to Cabron to Napoleon to Napito. We all just want to be called by the name our mom uses when she's not pissed off at us. Names are important. After all, the main occupation of most gang members, most of the time, is the writing of their names on walls. I recall on my first day of teaching at Loyola High School in Los Angeles in 1979, I was scared poopless about the prospect. With my arms filled with books, juggling the necessary cup of coffee, I walked to my first class. I stop in the doorway of a veteran teacher, Donna Wanland. She's at her desk, reading the Morning Times. "It's my first day of teaching," I say to her. "Give me some advice." She doesn't turn from her paper, but holds out her right hand, displaying two fingers. "Two things," she says. "One, know all their names by tomorrow. Two, it's more important that they know you than that they know what you know." Good advice. I followed it, and I think it served me in good stead. I remembered it when I arrived at Dolores Mission. Once I had made the decision to not be a slave to my office, I wandered the projects, often approaching, uninvited, the various groupings of gang members, which spotted every corner and crevice of the housing developments. The reception was almost always chilly. This changed only after I began to visit homies from the community who were locked up or wounded in the hospital. There was one kid in particular everyone knew as Cricket. To say that he would give me the cold shoulder would impugn shoulders. Cricket, 15 years old, would walk away when I approached and would return to the bola, I noticed, once I left. I investigated and discovered his name was William. One day I walk up to this group of gang members with Cricket among them, and he doesn't disappear on me. I shake hands with all of them, and when I get to Cricket, he actually lets me shake his hand. "William," I say to him, "how you doing? It's good to see you." William says nothing. But as I walk away, I always made a point of not staying very long, I can hear William in a very breathy, age-appropriate voice say to the others, "Hey, the priest knows my name. I have called you by your name. You are mine," is how Isaiah gets God to articulate this truth. Who doesn't want to be called by name, known? The knowing and the naming seem to get at what Anne Lamott calls our inner sense of disfigurement. As misshapen as we feel ourselves to be, attention from another reminds us of our true shape in God. I give credit for most of my gray hairs to a kid named Speedy. He was a thrill seeker in the world of Project Gangbanging, and I don't mean that in a good way. He was Evel Knievel, pulling off near-death-defying stunts, creeping into enemy territory, just so that he could, as it were, stick his thumbs in his ears, loll his tongue, and say neener, neener, neener at a bola vatos that hated him in a big way. More than a few times, I'd see him attempt one of these stick-your-head-in-the-lion's-mouth moments, and I'd chase his ass back to his barrio, screaming at him, red-faced, saying things my mother never taught me. "Are you fucking out of your mind? Do you want to get killed?" One afternoon, I'm in the sacristy at Dolores Mission, and per usual, I'm late for the 5 p.m. Mass. My glances out to the body of the church catch viejitas looking at their watches, shrugging at one another. I'm vesting as fast as I can. Speedy enters the side door. He's a lanky guy at 17, rail thin, but taut from, no doubt, being pursued by enemies all the time. He slides his two elbows on the formica countertop and perches his chin on his fists. I'm flipping through books to find the readings. "You know, G," he begins, "I don't really care if I live or die." I'm embarrassed to admit all I'm thinking of are the three old ladies who've been waiting for 20 minutes for La Misa to start. "Look, dog," I tell him, throwing a Guatemalan stole over my head, "I have to do Mass right now. It's going to have to do for the moment for you to know that I care whether you live or die." Speedy weighs this on some internal scale, and things balance. "Okay," he says, and I think the equivalent of phew. 3 hours later, I'm sitting at my desk. In my pastor days, I kept the front door of the parish office open, giving you a clear shot of my inner office and my desk. Speedy appears, and his mood seems elevated. He dives right in. Look, I don't want you to get red at what I'm about to tell you. This, of course, begins the reddening process for me. What you do? I ask as he